today, why has Boris Johnson changed his mind about the nanny state? And will his obesity strategy work? Remember this.
I mean, you can't eat cheese, can you? You can't eat cheese if you're a vegan.
It's an issue.
It's just a crime against, you know...
Cheese lovers.
Crime against cheese lovers.
Or this.
Indeed, I make one confident prediction. Under any circumstances, this country will be amply provided for, not only with Mars bars, but also with cheese and onion crisps.
Boris Johnson has never shied away from reminding us about his love of food. Last year, he rejected the idea of taxing junk food by first poking fun at his own weight.
There is an obesity problem in this country, speaking entirely personally. It's something we all...
And then insisting that to be slimmer, kids need to...
take more exercise and be more active. It's calories in, calories out.
But the idea that the government should not intervene more on obesity came before Boris Johnson's own brush with death that seems to have changed the way he thinks about his own weight and how we tackle this problem more widely. According to The Guardian's Felicity Lawrence, who has been investigating the way that we eat for more than 20 years, a strategy that cracks down on junk food ads and buy one, get one free sales is a small step in the right direction. But she knows from experience the might of the food industry and its biggest companies.
I've come up against them frequently, and the playbook they use is really familiar from tobacco, but also from the fossil fuel companies and how they've denied climate change for decades.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, how did Britain get so overweight? Felicity Lawrence, you're a special correspondent at The Guardian. Rates of obesity have hugely accelerated in recent years, but they've been rising in Britain ever since the 1980s. Before that trend began, how did a typical family eat?
Well, I think we've changed over many decades in our food habits. And if you go back to the 30s...
Sausage rolls are easy. When you made the pastry, put the meat in. It's a good idea to paint the edges with beaten up egg.
Families would typically spend 3 hours a day cooking, and they would be shopping on foot and shopping very regularly.
Small ones look more attractive and carry so much better. And of course they needn't all be filled with sausage meat. Boiled herring or cheese and anchovy make tasty alternatives.
You've got the war period when everything was rationed, food was in very short supply. But obviously gradually things changed. We had policies to really boost production, maximise production. Europe was very, very hungry and America was helping feed it. And we had all these subsidies and agricultural policies that increased production. You have more and more women going out to work. We've got very long working hours, so there's much less time for cooking.
Thanks, Mum. Daddy. Chips.
Oh, little girls.
McCain chips, Britain's most popular choice.
Chips.
And from 3 hours a day, that amount of time typically is now 15 minutes a day that we spend actually cooking food. We tend to shop less often and buy vast amounts in one go.
Make your day, make your way to the sign that says you're welcome. A visit to McDonald's makes your day.
We've got television and we've got adverts everywhere bombarding us, and there's been an enormous shift towards eating out of the home in more recent years and towards really heavily processed foods.
And where has that left our diets?
We've shifted towards producing an excess of precisely the kind of calories that are energy dense but very light in nutrition. They're empty calories by and large. So we've seen an enormous increase in production of corn, which is then made into sugar and starch, soya, which is broken down into its parts either for industrial fats for fast food or the protein bit to be fed to animals. So we've had this explosion in livestock production, very intense, which tends to go into more cheap processed meals.
So is that the problem, highly processed food?
I think at root, everybody accepts, other than the industry, that we are eating too much over-processed foods that's been stripped of its nutrition. One of the phrases people use is ultra-processing. You know, as the author Michael Pollan said, food-like substances. You know, they're barely food by the time they're finished. They've been stripped of so much.
And just within all of that, how important is the sugar that we're consuming through processed food?
We get sugar in so many different forms. In a ready meal, you might find 7 or 8 listings of different types of sugars that we don't necessarily realise are sugars, corn syrup or dextrose or lactose.
So way more sugar than we need.
We have absolutely no physiological need for refined sugar. The whole glories of the Renaissance were created without sugar, with about possibly a teaspoon per person per year. So it's something that we don't need. We're not evolved to process properly. It interferes with our hormone systems. There's some evidence that it suppresses the production of leptin, which is the thing that tells you you're full and tells you to stop eating. Sugar is a huge problem. And the whole way it works when you absorb it in refined form is that it stimulates the production of insulin, which rushes into the blood to metabolize it. And you get these highs and lows of blood sugar, which leave you with these crashes and feeling very hungry. So you get into this cycle where you overeat, you eat more because you get hungry.
But if we don't need this really quite dangerous substance, why is processed food full of it?
If you haven't got much real food that's not highly processed in a product, you're not going to get much flavour. So you add the flavour with salt and sugar. Just to give you one example of the economics, salt provides flavour to cheap bread or to a ready meal, about $150 a tonne. But if you wanted to put in real spices, they cost $2,000 a tonne. So the industry works with the cheap commodity ingredients. That's how the economics of it work.
What has this massive shift towards ultra-processed foods meant for our bodies?
Well, when you're filling up with highly processed foods, you're not eating the fresh fruits and vegetables that we know have a protective effect against diseases. You're quite likely to be overeating because you don't get the signals that you're full. We've got a huge problem in the UK with obesity. 63% of adults in England are overweight or obese, and 28% are fully obese. And I think it's even more shocking when you look at the figures for children. So 1 in 3 primary school children in year 6 are leaving their first school overweight or obese and have a sort of lifetime of struggle with their weight in front of them.
That is astonishing. And processed food is big business. These products come from huge multinational companies. What is it that attracts them to this market?
What attracts them to this market is this concept of added value. If you take a raw ingredient, like, say, American corn, and you process it into its constituent parts, so that's sugars and starch, it's incredibly cheap, partly because the American taxpayer pays most of the cost in subsidies. So you've got very cheap raw materials. You can't actually sell them direct to the public for very much. But if you turn them into something else, you start adding to your margins and you get very high margins on processed foods. You get relatively low margins on things like fruit and veg.
So is there an incentive to process more and more?
We've got very perverse economic incentives in our food system globally. There's about $500 billion are paid out in agricultural subsidies each year, and it's nearly always for the wrong sort of food.
Were the companies aware of the potential health risks of what they were producing? And if so, how early on were they aware of that?
I think from the 80s, it was pretty clear that there was a problem with processed foods and health. And I don't think they were fully aware right from the beginning, but I think the weight of evidence grew and grew and grew. And just as big tobacco fought off any kind of regulation or restrictions on their profits and manufacturing, the food and drink industry has been very adept and quite cynical at various points in using the same techniques, trying to sow confusion, to suggest the science isn't conclusive when the weight of evidence is overwhelming. They exploit the fact that long before you've absolutely proved what's happening, you know there's a very strong association that's worth acting on, but they would always say, well, you can't prove this yet. They would do things like set up sort of institutes to talk about anything but what the real problem was. So to have a research on physical activity and calories out to avoid having to say that there was any problem with calories going in. There are particular examples with things like trans fats where it became very clear that they were really harmful to health.
Trans fat is found in baked and fried foods or used for cooking at home, in restaurants, or by street food vendors. Trans fat clogs arteries, increasing the risk for heart attacks.
And the industry carried on using them, but started taking them out of really sort of high-end products that were being sold as healthy and left them in the other cheaper products they were happy to carry on selling to poorer countries or to people on low incomes.
Have you seen this obesity epidemic take hold in developing countries as well?
I mean, I went to South Africa where the big processed food and drink companies were sort of piling in and people in the townships were eating lots more highly processed food. And within the same family, you could find obese children and underweight children. People who are obese or overweight are malnourished. They are eating, you know, they're eating bad food and they are very often short of the nutrients they need, even though they're overweight.
Basically, we've known about this as a major health problem for decades. What have British governments done to try to address it?
Food is one of those rather unglamorous things. I think I've pondered this for a long time because it is so huge and so vital, and yet it's always rather far down the list of priorities. It's just not glamorous in terms of policy. Various governments have gradually tried to do things. It usually takes governments quite a long time to get round to thinking in a joined-up way about food strategy. It was by the end of the Labour years that they actually came up with some really joined-up thinking on how the need to change the food system actually affected almost every department, and you needed to think about it in terms of transport and how people were able to move around and take exercise. You needed to be able to think of it in terms of the environment. You needed to be able to think of it in terms of education and what you're teaching kids at school to catch them young. And they actually had a very joined up report which came out just at the end of Gordon Brown's tenure and, of course, gathered dust on the shelf.
Okay, so never enough of a priority, even where ministers want to make a change. But we also have this idea, perhaps from the industry, perhaps from right-wing think tanks and within government, that this is not really something for the state, that it's all about personal choice. How do you respond to that?
The problem with that is it's so clearly not about personal choice. It's about determinants of health, social determinants of health. And you see that in the inequalities. Your ability to choose the right thing depends on your income. It depends on where you live and what kind of access you have to good food. You may love cooking if you've got a lovely new kitchen in a nice house and you've got lovely shops and independent butchers and fishmongers and greengrocers around the corner, but that's not the reality for vast numbers of people. They might be really struggling to pay the fuel bills, so actually cooking for a long time isn't possible because they can't afford the fuel. You could be long to be responsible, but simply not have the right choices.
And presumably part of what takes away that personal choice is also what you're confronted with. So whether it's advertising that tempts you into eating certain types of food, or whether it's simply that so much more food is processed now.
Yeah, I think the environment is what we call obesogenic. It creates obesity because we are bombarded with messages and often a very kind of subliminal, sophisticated psychological manipulation from a very early age.
Hey, you need an afternoon snack?
Made with real mashed potato.
A little effort from you.
All you need for a great tea time.
All your favourites in one bag.
Cook less, live more.
So young kids don't distinguish between adverts and other kind of content. Industry knows that and they go for young people. And if you restrict them in one form of advertising, they find ways around it and will try and get them in other ways. So, you know, the whole environment is working against you. And I think any parent knows that. If you go to the shops and the confectionery is all at the level that your kids, you know, your small children's hands can just reach, and there's a queue and they're bored and you feel under siege quite often trying to resist all this.
You're talking about this as a poverty issue, but is processed food, junk food, really cheaper than cooking yourself?
The truth is, ultra-processed food is often cheaper than cooking for yourself. People who are out of touch with ordinary lives, as politicians so often are in Westminster, don't understand that actually the choices people on low income are making are quite often very rational. And somebody called Tim Lobstein did some fantastic research a few years ago where he calculated the cost of different foods per 100 calories. If you're on a low income, you've got very little money coming in, you've got hungry kids, you need to fill them up with calories. And he calculated if you wanted 100 calories of broccoli, which would be extremely good for you, it'd be 51p. But 100 calories from frozen chips was 2p. If you bought good sausages that had lots of meat and were low in fat and were relatively good for you, that was 22p for 100 calories. But the cheap, bottom-of-the-range, very fatty, full of E-numbers coloured version with not much meat was 4p per 100 calories, just a fraction of the price of the better one. Or if you look at something like fresh orange juice, that was 38p per 100 calories at the time. Compare that with a sugary orange squash, 5p per 100 calories. If you're on a low income and you don't have much spare money, you cannot afford to buy something to see if the kids will eat it. And if, you know, if they're going to turn their nose up at a new vegetable or something, you just haven't got that flexibility of testing things out. So you end up buying the same old things that they're used to.
Wow. So it's 25 times more expensive to choose broccoli over chips.
Yeah.
That is extraordinary. You just sort of assume that buying vegetables and cooking them will be the cheapest option.
It's not if you're worried about keeping your kids full and filled up with calories. The cheapest calories are the wrong kind of calories.
What does that inequality in terms of what we eat mean for people's lives?
It means that people who are on low incomes and living in deprived areas will have a shorter life and will have a much poorer quality life. So, for example, a child born in a deprived Glasgow suburb can expect a life that's 28 years shorter than another child just living 13 kilometres away in a more affluent area. And that was a finding from the World Health Organization. And they commented when they did that report that obesity is not caused by a moral failure of individuals. It's by the excess availability of high-fat, high-sugar foods.
OK, so what you're describing is a ticking time bomb. We know that successive governments have tried and failed to address this issue, but presumably the incentive to tackle it is now stronger than ever because of the very apparent health costs.
We've known there are huge health costs from eating the wrong kind of diet for a very long time. We know it increases your risk of getting diabetes, which shortens your life, and if it's not controlled, leads to amputations. We know it affects heart disease, it increases your risk of stroke, it increases your risk of lots of cancers, and it increases your risk of dementia. So that's been known for ages. And now that COVID has come along, people who have suffered complications or death from COVID have, but to a much larger degree, are obese. And if you are obese, you've got a 40% increase in risk of dying from COVID. If you're morbidly obese, you've got a 90% increase in risk. And the inequalities have been so visible. COVID has disproportionately hit people from poorer backgrounds and areas, and it's disproportionately affected minorities. Because that's been so visible on our screens and in the figures night after night, it's sort of the tipping point at last at which people realise you've got to do something about the bigger problem. And I think it's focused political minds very much on if we have a second round of COVID that coincides with winter, the NHS will not cope, and anything we can do to reduce the risk of complications from COVID because of weight is vital. And Matt Hancock said if people could just lose 5 pounds in weight it would save the NHS 100 million over 5 years. The cost of not doing anything have now become so glaringly obvious, both to the public and to politicians.
I've always wanted to lose weight for ages and ages, and I, like I think many people, I struggle with my weight, go up and down. But since I recovered from coronavirus, I've been steadily building up my fitness.
I think genuinely Boris Johnson as Prime Minister has had a moment of truth. He thought he might die from COVID, and he had it very forcibly brought home to him that he himself was overweight and that that was something that increased his risk factor. He seems to have had an epiphany.
Coming up, will Boris Johnson's epiphany actually change how we eat? Felicity, as you say, Boris Johnson's own experience of COVID has meant a pretty big change of heart. He's a politician who has railed against the nanny state in the past. Just last year, he talked about reviewing the sugar tax. He insisted he wasn't the sort of guy who would bring in a milkshake tax. But now his obesity strategy is pretty interventionist. Tell me what's in it.
It's got several different prongs to it, the strategy. One of the crucial things is it's trying to tackle advertising of processed foods high in salt, fat and sugar, and particularly where they're pre-watershed, although that's quite an old-fashioned notion. And it's talking about tackling them online too, which is really important. It's trying to make it possible for people to make better judgments about what they're eating, so there's going to be better labelling both on foods and in restaurants, so that you're aware how many calories you're getting from food that you're eating somewhere else than home. It's looking at bringing in initiatives on exercise, trying to improve bicycle lanes, give incentives to people to get on bikes with some cash to cover the cost. It's talking crucially about the fact that this is really difficult and it's no good being judgmental. People really do struggle when you're overweight. It's very hard to get back to a healthy weight, given the environment around you.
Just trying to help people a little bit to bring their weight down. Not in a excessively bossy or nannying way, I hope. We want this one really to be sympathetic.
And so it's talking about GPs being able to send people for help in the way that they could get help with stopping smoking.
How have the food industry responded?
The food industry, I've heard a lot of talk about, this is categorising all foods as bad, and high salt, high fat, high sugar products include things that are fine, like the olive oil or the cheese, and so it's, you can't do anything because it's not fair. But not just the food industry. The other really powerful vested interest in this is the advertising industry and the broadcasters. And we've had a lot of pushback from them saying it won't make any difference. The TV companies are putting out a figure that the government's own research into the impact of restricting advertising pre-watershed found that it would only make 1.74 calories per day difference to a child. That kind of comes to me in the sowing doubt, confusion, disinformation category, because if you actually go to the report, it says if that advertising is displaced, which we expect it to be, to other places, it would only make that tiny difference. Well, yes, but we're hoping that it wouldn't be good if we could stop it being displaced and just stop it altogether.
Obviously, they're coming up against resistance from big industries, but if the government stick to these points, how effective would it be, or is it pretty small fry?
I think it's hard to tell how effective these measures are. I think they're really welcome, and it is a real shift that that the Conservatives are taking it on. For the moment, there's an absence of joined-up thinking that's still troubling, and I think will get in the way of them being as effective as you would hope. Just to give you a couple of examples, so with trying to get the economy going, the Chancellor has come up with this scheme to give people a subsidy for eating out. So on the one hand, you get a subsidy for going eating out, and you can eat out at a fast Southern Fried Chicken place and get money off, which is completely in contradiction to their aims on obesity.
Not just a Southern Fried Chicken place, McDonald's, Burger King or Pizza Hut.
All sorts of big brand names. The other problem the government's got is that, it's a Brexit government, and its main strategy on getting out of Europe was to do quick trade deals with places like the US. And what the US is interested in a trade deal from us is opening up our market to its agricultural products, which the EU has quite successfully kept out in many cases. And that means more of the sort of foods that we're saying are not good for you. It means more corn, more soya, more cheap meat produced very intensively using those subsidised crops as feed. So there's a sort of mismatch between different bits of the government's thinking on how it runs the economy and how it helps Britain thrive. The government commissioned Henry Dimbleby to come up with a national food strategy, which would try and do more joined-up thinking on what we need to do in terms of climate and food security to make sure we've got enough, but also what sort of food we want. And that's very welcome. Whether it will actually be taken on board will be very interesting to watch.
What you're essentially saying is that this strategy would make a potential good start, that COVID has lifted the lid on the dangers of processed food that, frankly, we have known about for decades. But we're talking about a huge shift in the way we as a country eat, a shift that, as you say, began in the 80s, but has since totally transformed what we have in supermarkets, what we eat in restaurants, how we think about nutrition. And it's ushered in this new age of ultra-processed food. Surely to reverse that, needs something much, much bigger.
It does need something much bigger. It needs a rethink of how we run the economic system globally, which is a big ask. But I think the other thing that COVID has shown is that all the previous assumptions about things that were impossible have gone out the window. I mean, we have had enormous state intervention. We have had things that make it seem possible to tackle this and climate change. We've had people, you know, a halt on flights. It's something that needs huge leadership and vision of a different world that is possible. I think the other thing to hang on to is this kind of food is really only 50 years old maximum. We never, you know, in all the millennia of human development, it is a blip. And I think it is perfectly possible that it can be completely changed because there's not really an alternative. The costs of not doing anything are too high. The question is whether it's done in a managed way or whether it gets to the point where the health service is overwhelmed by diet-related disease or we have a crisis with food security that drives more and more migration. So you could have very disruptive, disturbed ways of changing the system or, with luck, somebody with the vision to think of things differently.
Felicity Lawrence, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was The Guardian's special correspondent, Felicity Lawrence, who has written an analysis of the obesity strategy at theguardian.com. Do have a look at that, as well as a comment piece by our health editor, Sarah Bosley, and from Patrick Butler, a write-up of Henry Dimbleby's national food strategy that was also published this week. Felicity has been investigating the food industry for many years. You can find lots of her work on the website, but she's also written books, and I'd really recommend Not on the Label, What Really Goes into the Food on Your Plate. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.